We are going to be doing a little time traveling here on The Conversation. The year was 1946. It was April Fool's Day, but what happened was deadly serious. A tsunami hit the sleepy town of Hilo, killing 159 people. An earthquake triggered the series of monster waves that caused damage on several of the Hawaiian Islands. First-person accounts tell a story of loss of life and property and the difficult recovery that followed. That we can reach back to access those voices, many in thanks to oral histories recorded while those memories were still vivid. It's timely, as April is Tsunami Awareness Month. We talk with Deviana McGregor of the University of Hawaii Center for Oral History and Ken Rubin with the Department of Earth Sciences. HPR's news director, Bill Dorman, starts us off with some firsthand accounts.
This was the most destructive tsunami to hit Hawaii in modern times. It killed 159 people, destroyed more than 500 homes and other buildings. The overall damages estimated at the time to be $26 million. Now, accounting for inflation, it's the equivalent today of more than $326 million in damages. All started with a powerful earthquake hitting the Aleutian Islands off the coast of Alaska, estimated at 8.6. One of the first casualties, the Scotch Cap Lighthouse on Unimak Island, the largest island in the Aleutians. All five lighthouse keepers were killed. No one could sound any kind of an alarm. It took nearly 5 hours for the first waves of destruction to roll into Hilo. And when they arrived, it was a shock. Alexander Riviere was 15 years old. He was headed to school the morning of April 1st, 1946. He shared his memories in an interview recorded in February 1999.
That particular day was All Fool's Day. Until I remember that, that time somebody tapped me, tidal wave, tidal wave. This guy's like pulling my leg again, you know. So I went across that. And I was atop the bridge, and here I am looking at, you know, just like when you look over a horizon, but here the water was going out. And they were really, really going out far. I could see the Hilo Bay. I could see the bottom. I seen that wave coming, you know. It was very, very big one. Very, very big. It seemed as though you could just like it was boiling. Boy, I'm telling you. It was the biggest and ugliest thing. Because it was black. It was black. The water over there is black because you have that black sand beach. So I catch, we gotta run. I don't know if we're gonna make it good up. My mom was already home, and she was the one that told my dad that probably I had gotten killed, you know, in the wave. Because I had gone to school at 7 o'clock. Yeah. The wave hit the main wave, one hit, 7:05. See, my dad was working in Kamuala. So when he got the report, he said, you better go home because they have a tidal wave or something in Hilo. So when he had saw me, he put his arm around me, he was kissing me in my mind. He was so happy to see me alive. But it was, he probably gave me a couple snaps too.
The chaos of that morning, he found his way home by following the railroad tracks. Another survivor called that first huge wave, she saw a great big black wall. James Lowe was 16 years old when he was nearly caught in the middle of it, driving down a road when he came up upon a policeman who probably saved his life.
As I headed down that road, on just about the bottom of that road, I began to enter Cam Avenue, a policeman, and I wish I knew his name because it has some bearing or some impact on me because I've wondered from that day on to today, you know, I just want to know who that person was. Not that he was sarcastic in any way, but when I got to that corner, he made the corner coming in from the Hilo side of that corner, turning up Kumu, and told me to get out of there. He yelled at me to get out of there. So I was shocked. So I just sat there, kind of wondering why he did that. And in the meantime, when I pulled my head up to look out towards the ocean. And lo and behold, I've never seen anything like it in my life, but it was this huge, huge, huge wave. I think I wouldn't be exaggerating, but it was taller than the Amfac building, the American Factors building that was sitting right on the ocean side of Cam Avenue. I wanted to turn around, so I turned the car into Island Motors, and by that time, the water had already struck, and I was already sitting in neck-high deep water in the automobile, feeling, and I could feel the car kind of floating you know, with the force of the wave that came in. When I finally came to my senses, I felt the car being sucked out back towards the ocean as the wave receded. And I, at that point in time, jumped out of the car, climbed through the window, not even thinking about opening the door. I jumped out of the window and headed up upland. I struggled through that current that was pulling everything back out towards the ocean, the receding tide, and I finally got to a fenced area that was situated between Island Motors and Motors Inn, and I was fortunate enough to grab that fence and climb over it, where the current wasn't, or the receding tide wasn't as strong. And from there, I made my way up Kumu Street and back home.
Just incredible stories of escape and survival. Hilo suffered the most losses from the tsunami in 1946, both in terms of human life and in property, but other areas were hit as well. Lapahoehoe on the Hamakua coast, 25 people killed, including students and a teacher who were in a school when the first wave struck. At least 77 homes on Maui were destroyed, but it was Hilo that took the most direct impact. And it was Hilo where the comeback was the most difficult. Areas where waves crashed through were just changed forever. That interview, by the way, was done in 1999 by Warren Nishimoto, who did most of these interviews. He was the director of the Center for Oral History for many years, recorded interviews for more than 30 years. He also spoke with a man who was on duty as a policeman that April day in 1946 when the tsunami struck. Robert Chow, nicknamed Steamy, was called on to help with a truly difficult job.
And I was asked to go down to the ice house, which is the Hilo Electric Light Ice House. It was a temporary morgue in the first locker. I was asked to go down there to try and identify bodies. And there, I couldn't identify the bodies, but it was real sickening to see small ones, several years old, among the victims. The Boy Scouts were around trying to help identify or recover certain things. And the labor union volunteered to work, and plantations and the big construction companies furnished all the equipment, so they were working cleaning up mess.
They start cleaning up that day?
They start doing it that day, and the county, the state used their equipment, and the labor work, they work continuously. So that it wasn't just I put in 8 hours, that's all. We just continue working because most of the workers had families, victims. So they want to help. And there's a lot of volunteers wanted to help. And yet there's a lot of people there looking for bargains. It's not looting because they discarded already. But they go down there and see what they can get. I didn't go down there, but they said there's more people down there than people helping. So there are a lot of things that were just with a bulldozer go right through, the crane, put it in the truck, and off they go down to the rubbish dump.
Did you actually see people looting, taking merchandise?
Yeah, we've seen
the cleanup now.
Yeah, the cleaning up. People would take some things and say, oh, so-and-so told me I could have it. And if you know who they are and who the owner was before, you can put two and two together. You let them go. We, take their word for it. So that's how, in those days, we control the crowd. Because not like now, there's too many outsiders or people that you don't know.
Steamy Chow is still on the police force in Hilo on May 23, 1960, when an 8.3 quake struck off the coast of Chile, and the tsunami that followed it again rocked Hilo, killing 61 people. But it also led to some changes, including the first efforts by the U.S. federal government to create the capability of an early warning system. 3 years later, in 1949, the government set up what is now the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center.
Wow, that's incredible history. Incredible history. Mm-hmm. Chicken skin. I mean, just listening to these stories, because this is the first time that I'm hearing it, you know, the description of the man in the car up to his neck in water. Wow. But what was it like for you, Debiana, when you were listening to this?
It's incredible how shocking it must have been for them. And I read the transcripts, but this is the first time I'm actually hearing the voices. And it makes a huge difference to hear the emotion that goes with the story as they're telling it, than just seeing it on the pages, which is why in our efforts now with the Center for Oral History, we're trying to have podcasts and other ways to have these voices be more accessible to our community, to build a sense of community and a sense of, you know, and learn from these experiences.
Ken Rubin also joins us with the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. What about you, Ken, if you're here just hearing this for the first time, too?
Yeah, and one of the things that struck me is, in addition to all the emotion, were the factoids that are embedded in a lot of these conversations, things that that we'd like the populace to know. For instance, that the water recedes oftentimes before a tsunami, that when it comes in as a wave, it's more like a tide than it is like a wave that you would surf at the beach, and that there's a series of waves, and so not only is the water coming in a problem, but also the receding water. And, one of those interviews talked a lot about fighting that current. It's a really interesting thing to hear it in people's voices. But these are all things that we know happen during tsunami. They can take place over quite a period of time as the waves come in and go out, and really very hazardous situation. And you hear that represented in those voices.
I know just things that struck me, the light keepers that were killed.
Yeah. And that, you know, when you look at time and things that are different, but to be in an age where that was not an option, to know that, to have that advanced knowledge is just chilling. And to hear that, those voices of, oh, it's April Fool's Day, somebody, you know, pulling my leg on this, just astounding.
That was an excerpt from a previous Oral History call-in show, an example of some of the new projects we're undertaking here on The Conversation, another reason to support Hawaii Public Radio.